Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to The Back Half, the New Statesman's Culture Podcast with me, Tom.
And me, Kate.
We were just talking about how woefully unwoke our political radar is. In one of the early podcasts back in September last year, in the series, we went to see Morrissey. And you might remember it was a gig he did at Maida Vale for the BBC. And even if you didn't hear it, you probably kind of encountered the sort of social media storm afterwards, because he made some very like offhand and sort of slightly indecipherable comment, didn't
poorly
he?
Structured joke, yeah, about Anne-Marie Waters.
Yeah, it was one of the many UKIP leadership contests, and Anne-Marie Waters hadn't got it, and
he made a rigged vote.
Yeah,
he said.
Exactly. Yeah,
yeah.
People took this as an endorsement of her. She's a fairly dodgy anti-Islam campaigner.
She was the one that didn't Farage call her a fascist.
Yeah,
something.
She's basically too far right for UKIP.
So we were in this BBC studio in Maida Vale, and you know, in the little bubble, we were just thinking, what a wonderful creation Morrissey is. And we came out, and there was this massive media shitstorm going on. We're like, just let the man be free to make his art. That joke was harmless.
Yeah,
and we talked about it as much on this podcast as well, and we said, you know, it's all been blown out of proportion. It wasn't a far-right comment at all.
Now, well, about a week ago, Morrissey came out with a kind of self-organized interview on his website in which he not only endorsed Anne-Marie Waters, but also endorsed the party that she formed in October last year called For Britain.
Yeah, so it was part of a long game. And we thought it was a terrible overreaction. And we briefly hated 2017 at that point. And modern people and phones and Twitter and everything. But yeah, we are the non-woke podcast, I'm afraid.
So today we are not going to be talking about Morrissey, but we are going to be talking about a rather extraordinary British debut film called Beast.
And we're going to be talking about a long-running Radio 4 show called Soul Music, which you may or may not have heard, which has just, I believe, been moved slots as well. So it's sort of slightly more accessible to you now if you're sort of listening to the radio after 9 o'clock in the morning, as a lot of people are. And we will have the millionth, because we've done a million of these podcasts
have
now.
Have we?
Amazing. Have, yeah.
Celebration.
We'll have the millionth non-iversary, the cultural event of some small significance that took place at some point in the past.
So Kate and I have just seen Beast, which was reviewed by our film critic Ryan Gilby in last week's magazine. It's a debut feature film from a British director called Michael Pearce, set on Jersey. Very beautifully shot, starring Jesse Buckley as Moll and Johnny Flynn as Pascal. These two kind of slightly disturbed lovers who come together at a time on the island where there's a serial killer, or what appears to be a serial killer, on the loose. And the film plays with your expectations and assumptions about these two characters and about the community at large. It's very disturbing and completely gripping.
He thinks you're the man that's been killing those girls. Do you think it's me?
Hey, don't walk away from me!
What the fuck do you want from me?
I want you to tell me that you didn't do it. I lied for you. I said we were together that night, and I need to know I did it for the right reason.
Yeah, well, you don't need to lie for me anymore. I'll get through this by myself.
Oh, God, I don't understand you.
How can you ask me that? I love you, and you're asking me that.
So that was Johnny Flynn and Jesse Buckley in Beast. Johnny Flynn having a second career or another part to his career anyway.
My mother is in her late 60s and she's used up all the data on her phone watching clips of Johnny Flynn because she really fancies him. He's 35. And she couldn't work out why her phone wasn't working anymore. She'd get really annoyed with it. Is it the internet connection? And my brother had to point out, no, you have used up all your data on YouTube. So Johnny Flynn is a folk singer and was a folk singer initially. He actually got a music scholarship to Beedale's and he wrote all the music for the Detectorists series. So he wrote the entire soundtrack and he sings the theme.
Nice music in that as well.
Very nice. And he also wrote the music for a Globe production of As You Like It using Renaissance instruments. So the guy is like, he's a smart guy. And this is one of his sort of first lead roles. He did play the young Einstein in one of those National Geographic Genius series.
Ah, the one that we've just had Picasso.
I noticed that you have the new issue in front of you in which we review the Picasso series, and I just noticed the caption on the picture of Antonio Banderas as Picasso. It just says, endlessly randy. Antonio Banderas as Picasso. Yeah, so my mother's had this fixation with him for a long time, but he is he's a very, very watchable guy. And he's got sort of some interesting stuff going on with his face as well, because he was savaged by a Staffordshire Bull Terrier when he was a little boy. So he has scars from that. And yeah, it's unusual to see someone make the transition from being a sort of very convincing folk singer to acting so endlessly. But I think he's been doing it for a few years.
He's got a very kind of weather-beaten look in this. His character is, he's an outsider character. His parents are absent. And we kind of first encounter him as a sort of, in a kind of woodsman role. He's got a rifle and rabbits in the back of his van or back of his car, and he rescues Moll from the kind of unwanted attention of a pretty sinister guy. The film's called Beast, and it's interesting when you see people writing about this. Everyone like picks up different fairy tales to, like, I noticed Ryan refers to her as a Red Riding Hood.
Yes,
and the director talks about her as a Cinderella character. Because her home life is, she's very, very put upon. She's got this incredibly, chillingly domineering mother.
The mother's like something out of a Michael Haneke film, right?
Yeah, and she's like a wicked stepmother as well, isn't she?
Totally steely, repressed mother who obviously fancies her boyfriend as well, which is brilliant.
Did you think?
I thought so. And every move, every moment that the mother makes to try and stop Moll seeing this new boy pushes Moll further towards the boy. So it's like a very kind of, it's an interesting examination of mother-daughter dynamics as well, and the kind of mirroring that goes on there. I think Ryan particularly points out its fairy tale quality as well, and I think I was wondering why it feels so much like a fairy tale, and it's incredibly solid and gripping, and it's got a kind of archetypal power about it. There's no technology, we were thinking about this, there's no modernity in it really. The pacing is perfect, the way that the romance develops given, you know, between these two people, it's a lot of the film is given over to that sort of first 2 weeks of their relationship and the escalation of it. And it's, the weather is incredible. It's summer. I don't know how they did this, but it's a very English summer, but it's also slightly more hyper-real and beautiful than English summers really are. So she's always, even if it's 4 o'clock in the morning and she's walking through a forest, she's wearing a tiny little summer dress and she's covered in mud and she never looks cold, but they're not really like sweating in the sun either. So it's kind of, it had this very English quality, but almost sort of too good to be true somehow.
I love that scene when she's walking through the forest at 4 a.m, and it really captures that kind of grainy 4 a.m. light. The other thing that makes it very fairy tale, I think, is, as Ryan says, Red Riding Hood, this redheaded heroine kind of instantly, you know, this kind of pale-skinned redheaded heroine instantly puts you in that place. But then when they use the kind of the earth, she comes back once to her pristine house covered in mud and kind of the mud under her fingernails is kind of being rubbed off on this sort of perfect perfectly cream sofa and mud all around her mouth and stuff. She's kind of like, she really kind of gets down and dirty in the Jersey mud. I think the fact that it's set on Jersey as well gives it this kind of slightly far away quality.
I love how they're not metropolitan youth, yes, who are trying to get out. They,
yeah.
She works on what they call the granny wagons, the tour buses, giving old people tours of Jersey, and he's a handyman and stuff. And they're very rooted in Jersey social structures, yeah, and Jersey life, again, which, yeah, makes them feel sort of cut off from what we usually see in films in a way.
And the director, Michael Pierce, did grow up on Jersey.
Ah, did he?
Yeah. So I think that's lived.
So what else has he done? Like, what's his story?
He spent 7 years making this film.
No.
Yeah. Which kind of, when you see something like this, I mean, not, I'm sort of almost encouraged that it took him 7 years, because it's the product of hard work as well as sort of genius, I think. But yeah, no, he grew up in Jersey and has talked about how it was quite a kind of different and stifling place to be. And then film school, and then just kind of making commercials and short films and things. And the starting point for this, which you'll be interested in if you don't know about it already, was The Beast of Jersey. Do you know about this guy?
I remember that, yeah.
So he was a guy called Edward Paisnell, who was a serial rapist and paedophile.
You're just saying you'll be interested in that,
yeah,
Kate.
You will.
It's right up my street.
There's no irony involved in that. I'm just stating a fact.
Tell me more about The Beast of Jersey.
He just went on a kind of, he didn't murder anyone, but he went on this sort of terror spree.
What era?
This is late 60s, early 70s. I think he was arrested in 1971. And so Michael Pierce is about our age, but he said even growing up in the 80s, I guess it would have been, that was a kind of thing, you know, that they were all very aware of. So that was his starting point. But I think as he wrote the film, he kind of moved further away from the real life thing. But he did become obsessed with serial killers. He said he spent 2 summers in the library reading books about Bundy and all these serial killers.
Well, in a small community as well, that's this is why American serial killers have such sort of power in the popular imagination, because if it's a small town, it's just closer to you. It's a fact.
Yeah.
Like, it is somewhere hovering around the periphery of your life, whereas in a big city, it could be, you know, the guy could be anywhere. I think that what's good about this is that, you know, for me, the sort of serial killer type violent subplot,
yeah,
is secondary to the romance, and it's one of the most powerful kind of sexual chemistries that I've seen on screen in recent years. And I was trying to think about why that is, and I think it captures that thing about relationships where it's not just two star-crossed lovers who happen to really get on. It's what one brings out in the other. And it's like a dance, you know. There's something, not giving anything away, to say that she has a kind of a difficult past. There is a violent episode, yeah, buried in her past. And she sees in his violence her own. And it's about a kind of power play between who is really the wild one.
Yeah.
And Ryan has this beautiful line in his film. He says they're constantly unnerving each other.
Yeah.
So they're taking it in turns to be the one that distrusts the other one and kind of going away from each other and coming back. And that sense that she is activated by his roughness, and that helps her break out of her own prison that she's in with her family. So really, it's kind of a very realistic portrayal of what a relationship can do, like how it can free you, I suppose.
Yeah, and they both have the perfect destabilizing mixture of vulnerability and violence and power. And Moll, played by Jessie Buckley, I've only seen her in one thing, but she was in Taboo, which was the I thought was kind of bonkers, genius Tom Hardy vehicle. When I say vehicle, it really was a Tom Hardy vehicle. But she plays a very kind of savvy, smart, high-class actress figure. Completely different, like totally self-assured. So it was nice to see her range in this. Mm. I think that kind of relationship, it's so much harder to get that with actors later on in their career, I think, because like as soon as they're established and then you're like assessing these two famous actors, and do they have chemistry? And you kind of, you really struggle to believe it. But when you've got two kind of young, reasonably untested actors, I think they can create something quite
special. Quite a sort of poignant moment to see them both. Actually, she's in the Woman in White adaptation at the moment, which she's really good in, by all accounts. And he is sort of at the start of his film career proper. And you can imagine them trying to turn him into the new, like, you know, the lead of the new McMafia series or something,
yeah,
and shave his head, take him over to Hollywood, put him in a suit.
Don't do it.
I mean, he probably will do it, but he's I don't know, he sounds like sort of quite an eccentric character in his own way if he's writing music for Crumhorns and Sackbutts. So you kind of hope that he can, but yeah, you're right, that because they're blank slates in the public eye, there's just this, and they're not an obvious, like they are an obvious couple, but they're not as well, you know.
Yeah.
It's just really beautiful. And I suppose the big question that it asks is like, who's really the beast, you know?
So Beast is in cinemas now and thoroughly recommended.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So, Kate, I'm really grateful to you for bringing this program to my attention. Soul Music, which I learned now has been running since 2000, and I've never
since 1955, like Desert Island Discs,
never stumbled across it on Radio 4. But it's completely compelling. Can you remind me what it's about?
This is a long running program that takes a song every week and explores the meaning of that song in the lives of two or three different speakers. There is no host. And Antonia Quirk has written about it for us this week, because we just got intrigued about how it's made. Because what you notice is you're listening to, you know, an entire programme given to God Only Knows or something by the Beach Boys. And you've technically got ordinary people telling about their sort of relationships to this song. But they're not ordinary people. They're people with extraordinary experiences and extraordinary lives. And you just think, how on earth did they find them? How big is the team of people working on this program that's managed to pick out of the entire planet the most touching, the most moving stories? And so we asked Antonia to look into it a bit, and we found out some very interesting things about its production.
Such as?
Such as there is only one producer on each show, and that's it.
Amazing.
There's a staff of one. They are given...
So kind of each show is effectively a labour of love.
A labour of love of one person who is only really allotted the 3 days' work on it by the BBC.
Wow.
And the longest one of these episodes took to make was 5 years. It took one of these producers 5 years to get together the material they wanted on a Wagner piece.
For which they charged invoice to the BBC for three
for
days.
For 3 days. And
it's a bargain.
Most of the research is done trawling through wedding videos, personal blogs, Facebook, to find the sort of most striking connections to particular very famous pieces of music. And then maybe, you know, interviewing people over Skype or by iPhone when they're sort of stuck over on the other side of the world, and then putting it all together. But I mean, what was your, why do you think it works?
It's just such a brilliant structure. I think not having a host, I think what they do is really clever in that they give you a little bit of kind of the story of the song, because they often have maybe one of the voices is someone with a genuine connection to the creation of the song. So for instance, God Only Knows, they have Al Cooper, who was a musician in California at the time, who's kind of on the periphery, invited over to Brian Wilson's house with him, where he's playing his piano in the sandbox. There's a brilliant bit in that where he just says, he's sitting there playing the piano in the sandbox in his living room. There's a soda fountain in there. You know, these are things that aren't in many people's living rooms. So there's a little bit of kind of inside information on the song. And then you just get these extraordinarily emotional stories from completely unexpected places. And it's really beautifully edited as well. They're all woven through. You get the song itself coming in and out. They might mix in a cover version or a sort of unexpectedly stripped down version or a demo version, but they never give you any, and I've seen online, this has annoyed a couple of people, but there's no information on what they're playing. You know, on one of the classical ones, someone was saying, I want to know what version this is. But it's not about that at all. It's about the resonances these songs have for people. I wonder, for example, if we're talking about the God Only Knows ones, you've got Al Cooper, you've got a woman talking about how much it meant to her parents, which is quite a quiet story in a way, and how it was the connection, how it was sort of the glue between her parents. Then you've got this Christian couple, don't you?
Missionaries, yeah. Out in Burundi. And the producer of this show, Nicola Humphreys, found a wedding video on a 3 a.m. trawl of the internet of this couple dancing to God Only Knows, and manages somehow to find out that they're actually two missionaries who met and fell in love and obviously, you know, took their relationship in a very religious manner.
Yeah.
They met, so they had a walk together and they told each other that they would possibly like to spend their lives together. And then the young woman, Ruth, went off to swim in a local lake and she asked God whether Claude was the man that she was supposed to spend her life with. He said yes. So she went back to Claude and said, you know, and now they're a missionary couple working over there. And their relationship, of course, to God Only Knows is such a literal interpretation of the lyric. It's, yes, that beautiful thing where,
yeah,
it leaves the hands of the writer of the original songs. And it literally is about, well, God said this is okay.
Yeah.
Therefore, we're going to dance to this at our wedding.
And also the sort of comfort of, you know, she speaks with sort of great happiness about the fact that the song symbolizes everything being in God's hands. Basically.
Yeah. I it made me think a bit about the special relationship that we have to radio, in particular Radio 4, which is that it's sort of on in the room, you're getting on with stuff and you kind of come in and out. And for that reason, it can be very irritating in that you kind of catch snatches of programs and you want to know what's going on. And I had quite a difficult relationship with soul music for a long time because it annoyed me the way the songs faded in and out,
right,
for 2 or 3 seconds. And I was trying to follow something and I found it difficult to follow. And it just made me think about how it turns us into like grumpy old people shouting at the radio, because in a way we're so invested in it. We know these programs are fantastic.
Mm.
It's a bit like The Long View, you know, I think it's on Tuesdays. It compares to something from the present day to a thing of historical import, and it draws these parallels between them. So there was a great program recently comparing driverless cars to the railway boom of the 1830s, and it's absolutely immaculate. It's a beautifully done program, apart from the fact that they always get a trained actor to read out the official documentation of the time in a very dramatic Simon Callow-esque voice. And so you're kind of throwing things at the radio going, oh, why are you putting that silly voice on? This is a great show. And I had that with soul music. I thought, like, why are you playing such short clips? Who are these people? And then I realized there was a particular episode where I remained in the kitchen for the entire time because of how gripping the story was. And it was an episode on Boys Don't Cry by The Cure. And it was the writer Poorna Bell talking about her relationship with her husband, the journalist Rob Bell. And she started right at the beginning, total like blank sheet of paper. And she described the way they were set up on a date and the way he wasn't the kind of person she imagined she would like. And you're gripped thinking it's a love story. And then over the time in their marriage, she realized that he suffered terribly from depression. 3 years into the marriage, he told her he had a heroin habit. They ended up breaking up despite sort of working on the marriage for ages. And then he eventually committed suicide. And I remember just standing in the kitchen listening to this song with Boys Don't Cry coming in and out. And I had to literally go and redo my eye makeup because I was crying so much. And I thought, that's why soul music's a really good program. So you've got to give it time and you've
definitely
got to stay in one place, yeah, while you're listening.
It's not background listening.
No, it's irritating background listening.
And it's interesting because I think on paper, half an hour seems too long for it. I think, you know, you can imagine a producer being pitched this and say, well, that's a 15-minute, you know, that's a 15-minute show. But actually, the half an hour gives them the room to kind of develop, tell these full stories. And the way they get these people to open up is incredible, really. And there are, it's interesting because in that episode and in several others as well, there's often one story in there which isn't explicitly linked to the song. So a lot of the stories, either at the beginning or the end, they make, you know, it's, and this song helped me because, helped me through this because of X, Y, or Z. For instance, in that Boys Don't Cry one, there's a British athlete who describes, you know, moving in a different way, but his sort of last chance at the Olympics, and he has this horrible injury and he can't make it for the next sort of 200 meters or whatever. And he just ends up breaking down, crying, and his dad comes down to like comfort him. But there's no, he's not saying, and that's why I love the Cure song. Like, he doesn't mention
it. I've forgotten it.
Just, it's just the producer or whoever has decided that this is something that perfectly illustrates the theme of the song, which it does.
Didn't his dad walk him to the finishing line or something as well? It was something really.
Everyone's trying to stop him, basically saying like, you don't need to do this. He's like pulled his hamstring or something. He's obviously in terrible pain and is limping through the last, you know, determined through some sort of misguided idea that he has to finish it. The breadth of stories is really wonderful, and then you get some that have a kind of a genuine, you know, I listened to the one on Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come, so that's a politically very, very important song, so you get personal stories there, but you also get a bit more of the kind of political context, and you hear from Sam Cooke's brother. I mean, how do they get all these people?
I don't know.
They just get Sam Cooke's brother
on no budget.
Maybe this is why some of them take 5 years, but you know, Antonia points out that they don't use archive material, so which is must make life much more difficult for them, you know, doing God Only Knows. I bet they could have dug up clips of Brian Wilson or whoever, but they insist on kind of going to these people fresh. So
what was the, in Antonia's piece, she talks about Frankie Valli talking about singing one of his songs to a load of Vietnam vets.
Oh yeah.
I have a feeling it was Can't Take My Eyes Off You. And he'd never told this story before. And if it was that song, that very scene appears in The Deer Hunter. I mean, it's before they've gone off to Vietnam, but it's the last night before Christopher Walken and Robert De Niro go off to Vietnam.
Right.
And it's one of the most kind of gutting moments in the film because everyone's been drinking all night and Christopher Walken has sung this song while he's playing pool. And then everybody just stands around and like stares into their glasses thinking like, tomorrow we go over the top. So it's an amazing kind of match of fact and fiction that Valli actually sang it to a load of Vietnam veterans when they came back and they were still in their uniform. I mean, when in terms of finding these stories from ordinary people, that's what made me sort of, it reminded me of the Desert Island Discs episodes where they choose people who are not well known.
Yeah.
It's just that kind of needle in a haystack thing in terms of production. How do they start when they don't know the story is there? How do they pick that unknown person and, or, you know, that sort of non-famous person? And find these life stories. And again, that's why I thought it must have a huge team of people working on it. And to think that it's one person on
I know.
Each show, it's just...
Yeah. It speaks also to this idea of, you know, which we tried to tap into a little bit in the Christmas issue of The New Statesman that we worked on, where we asked writers and various NS contributors to talk about an album that is important to them in some way. And the distinction between the sort of difference between my favorite song or my favorite album and one that actually means something to you or kind of has shaped your story in some way is quite an interesting one, because if you're asked what your favorite album is, you kind of leaf through the part of your brain marked sort of critically acclaimed or, you know, like how do I impress the person I'm talking to? Well, maybe you don't. But that kind of is often the sort of gut instinct. But actually, you know, when you're asked to think about a piece of music that really means something to you, it's often, you know, it's often completely different.
Yeah, and it's often not the cool one that you want to show as your favorite album. So it is very. I mean, we did a big feature on it in the Christmas issue.
Yeah, and some of those stories, like the nicest ones, were, you know, George Saunders talking about being a teenager and listening to Yes and kind of having an epiphany about what it means to be an artist.
Yes, and he also said that wasn't it wonderful to see, I think, a young person, I think in the form of maybe Steve Howe, being able to express music so happily,
yeah,
which was a complete antithesis of the whole punk era and everyone being sort of pissed off and indie-ish and cool. And it's just like, he just loved the fact that he was playing his guitar so well and looked happy while doing it. And there's something about that attitude that you see in Saunders' writing. It's part of his ethos.
And you talked about a Paul Simon record.
Rhythm of the Saints, which was the one that came after Graceland. It was non-political in the way that Graceland was political in it, but it used musicians from South America. And it's just a kind of an amazing sort of hot record. You put it on and it's full of images of like lizards scuttling down cabin walls and song dogs barking at the break of dawn and lightning pushing the edge of a thunderstorm and all these amazing images. And it's recorded with, you know, a battalion of 100 drummers and stuff. And you put it on now and you are instantly back in that family holiday that you had in 1991, where you wind the windows down in the car and just hit with a wall of hot air and stuff. And I think there are lots of people who have a very visceral connection to that Paul Simon record. And it's not one that's like critically talked about very much. It did very well, but you know, it's no Graceland in people's
It's not
mind.
Lyrically, you know, it's interesting with these soul music choices because some of them, the meaning very obviously comes from the lyrics, but whereas some of them it's from the music.
Yeah.
And you know, the lyrics of Graceland are kind of so rich, but for Rhythm and Saints, it's more about the music and the texture.
What would you choose, do you think, if you had to choose one that was a life album rather than a favourite album?
I think a lot of the contributors to that feature homed in on a kind of adolescent period. And I do think that's probably where I would go to as well, because you're just sort of obsessively listening to the same albums over and over again. So, you know, while it's not sort of particularly original or cool, it would probably be one of maybe three records that I just listen to obsessively on the bus to school every night going to sleep. So it might be like Jeff Buckley's Grace, for instance, where you know every single note, you know, like the back of your hand. Or maybe Nick Drake's Pink Moon. I'd like to hear a soul music on Nick Drake's Pink Moon, actually. It's a weird song. I was re-listening to it. The lyrics are almost nothing. He just repeats the phrase Pink Moon. And I just realized in re-listening to it that I'd always misheard the first line, which I always thought was, saw it written on a suicide. But it's actually just saw it written and I saw it say. It doesn't even make any sense.
You made it so much darker than it was. Your teenage mind.
Yeah. So soul music is now, I looked this up, so I have information and everything. It's on Wednesdays and it's on at 9 in the morning and also 9:30 in the evening.
And they're currently apparently working on Night Swimming by REM. So if you've got a story... Yeah. Phone the BBC. Make it a good story.
As with the brilliance of iPlayer, there's loads of them online, so you can actually kind of properly binge on this, as I've been doing for the last few days. So, Kate, our non-anniversary this week, 18 years ago, is it 18 years? Yeah, 18 years ago this week, what happened?
Gladiator hit the screen. This is not a non-specific, non-important cultural event, because this was a huge cultural event.
Although, having said that, when I told Claire, my wife, that we were doing Gladiator, she was like, oh, great, can't wait. And then it emerged that she thought I was talking about Gladiators.
That's true.
The TV series.
Well, we could do that another week. Yeah. That's then, and that prefigured Gladiator, didn't it? We went, my entire floor at university went to see this at the Odeon Tottenham Court Road. It was the first time I laid eyes on Joaquin Phoenix as the Elvis-resembling, snivelling, incestuous, sadistic Commodus, the emperor who was thought to have brought about the fall of Rome, begun the fall of Rome. I found out that Jack Gleeson modelled Joffrey in Game of Thrones on Joaquin Phoenix.
That makes total sense. Yeah.
Brilliant, brilliant performance. I think his first line in it is he runs up to some battlefield where extremely bloody battle has just taken place, and he goes, "Am I too late, Father? Did I miss the battle?" And it just goes downhill from there. It's absolutely brilliant. Apparently, Mel Gibson was offered the lead role of Maximus, Russell Crowe's part, and turned it down because he said he was too old. Thank God it wasn't Mel Gibson.
Yeah, that would have been
a totally different film.
Yeah. Was that pre or post Braveheart? I get post Braveheart.
I think it was just post Braveheart. Yeah.
I guess maybe that made him the obvious choice for another sort of sword-wielding historical figure. I've just got one sort of interesting fact about Gladiator. Shall I do it now?
Do it now.
Which I discovered when I was... this isn't, other people know this, it's not knowledge that only I am privy to, but when I interviewed Nick Cave a few years ago, I was reading his novels and doing a bit of research, and I discovered that he had written a script for a sequel to Gladiator, Gladiator 2. Russell Crowe had approached Nick Cave directly to write the sequel. And Nick Cave sort of said, yeah, I'm kind of interested, didn't you die? You know, didn't you die at the end? Did I miss the ending? Or wasn't that you die? And he's like, you work that out. So Cave wrote this. I mean, I wonder whether there's a version of this circulating somewhere in Hollywood, but Cave wrote a version of this where the Maximus character goes down to purgatory, and then the gods are all dying out because this Christ figure has come to earth.
Wow.
And the many sort of Greek and Roman gods are really suffering. And so they send Maximus down to kill Christ.
Oh my God.
And his followers.
Was Christ going to be played by Mel Gibson?
Cave wanted, so this is going to be called Gladiator 2, Christ Killer.
No.
Yes.
Is that real?
Yeah. Well, this is what Nick Cave says anyway. Maybe he's having us all on. But Russell Crowe's talked about it as well, and Ridley Scott.
Crowe was, sorry, go on.
Then the bit I always remember for this is like, so that's the kind of setup. And then he becomes this sort of eternal, like endlessly replicating warrior. And so the last 20 minutes of Cave's script has him, this Maximus character, just fighting in every war in history, like up to Vietnam. Anyway, Ridley
wow.
Scott said it was a brilliant piece of work, but no one would ever make it.
So I found out that Russell Crowe was continually unhappy with the screenplay by William Nicholson, and he kept rewriting parts of it, and he would strop off the set. And there's a famous line in there where he goes, "I will have my vengeance in this life or the next." And he initially refused to say it. And he told William Nicholson, "Your lines are garbage, but I'm the greatest actor in the world and I can make even garbage sound good." And I thought, so what else did William Nicholson do? Because this obviously wasn't a very good relationship between the pair of them. William Nicholson did the screenplay for Les Miserables, which Russell Crowe was the lead in. So this, maybe they actually love each other.
Yeah.
This is just a kind of eternal fight between the two of them throughout their careers. But yeah, I don't think he was particularly easy to get on with. I just want to watch it again now, but it's long, and I think that now that I'm in the age of two screening or three screening, I'm not sure if I could focus for the entire time.
You could focus. It's I rewatched the ending, I have to say, which is his death scene, where it kind of goes into this sort of Instagram filter world.
Yeah.
Of the ancient,
so a lot of blue filter
wheat fields of Elysium, where he goes and meets his wife and children.
I think it invented the slow motion battle as well.
Did it?
Yeah, like the opening battle scene is in a field in Surrey, right, that was set for deforestation, and Surrey Council were just like, "You can burn it if you want." So they just slashed it and burned it. And for some reason it became blurry, so they then turned it into slow motion, but it was an accident or something. And then you just see that everywhere now, and you see they also thought, and I've heard some rock star say this the other day, that the Colosseum was too small. So that's why they CGI'd it. They were disappointed by this puny little Colosseum.
I'll tell you where you saw that.
Where was that?
You saw it in a review that we published in the New Statesman magazine, which we both work on, of the memoir of YouGod of the Wu-Tang Clan. There's one bit where he goes to the Colosseum and he just writes about how disappointing it was. He thought it was going to be massive, but it was more like a little league stadium.
Well, he's not the only one, because Ridley Scott was disappointed. So that's why they build this massive one. And to this day, people who go to see the Colosseum are disappointed because they've seen Gladiator. They think it's going to look like that.
Yeah, he specifically referenced Gladiator. He's like, I was on this Hollywood idea of what the Colosseum looked like. So
it's done a lot of damage.
Lies. It's just post-truth began with Gladiator in May 2000. But I think we're probably both going to go away and rewatch it.
We had the soundtrack on CD.
Hans Zimmer, yeah. It's a good working soundtrack, actually. We often talk about working music, but
yeah.
Claire works.
Because it's sort of shapeless singing as well, isn't it? It's
Happy non-anniversary at Gladiator. Thank you for downloading this episode of The Back Half. Do get in touch on Twitter. rate us on iTunes, listen to the other New Statesman podcasts. We have been edited by our podcast supremo, Caroline Crampton. And I want to leave you with Hans Zimmer's score to Gladiator, but I think a very, very close second best to that
is the musical Kick in the Balls, that is Pistol Jazz and Godspeed.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.